Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
Institutional investors deserve tailored portfolio solutions created by investment experts who understand their portfolio needs. MetLife Investment Management's client-first approach to managing public fixed income, private capital, and real estate assets is institutional, but far from typical. Learn more at MetLife.com/institutional. That's MetLife.com/institutional.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Andrew Peach, and in the early hours of Monday, the 16th of December, these are our main stories. The longest UN climate summit has ended, but it hasn't made that much of a difference. Indian police have been accused of forcefully entering a university campus and beating students. And rebels in the Democratic Republic of Congo have killed more than 20 people during an overnight machete attack. Also in this podcast...
The first day I went there, I looked and I saw so many girls. And what you do is you sit down and then a man has to come and choose.
An undercover investigation into the women being trafficked from Africa to India for prostitution. And why unidentified pills are being found in cakes and biscuits in Iran. The longest UN climate talks on record have ended in Spain, but with little to show after the marathon of negotiations. Exhausted delegates agreed that wealthier nations need to urgently develop fresh plans to curb their emissions, but many big questions, including proposals for carbon trading, are left unanswered. The UN Secretary General, Antonio Guterres, said an opportunity for real change had been missed, a sentiment echoed by Carolina Schmidt, the Chilean minister who chaired the talks.
The world is watching and waiting for concrete and bigger solutions from us. We are not satisfied. The agreements reached by the parties are not enough to urgently confront the crisis of climate change. The consensus is still not there to increase ambition to the levels that we need. The new generations expect more from us.
Our science editor David Shukman has more.
Madam President, would you give us just a few minutes?
And we want to look at the documents, but we are lost in the website.
I'm terribly sorry, Madam President, we can't find the document.
We are kind of lost.
Confusion and fatigue among delegates in the final hours of a marathon set of talks. Some arguments were technical over how to account for carbon emissions, which proved so difficult they were put off to next year. Other disputes were more fundamental over commitments for deeper cuts in emissions, as demanded by the latest science, but resisted by some of the biggest polluters, including Australia, the US and Brazil. For the most vulnerable developing countries, the outcome was disappointing. Tina Steger is an envoy from the Marshall Islands in the Pacific.
Right now, I'm exhausted. I feel like much, much more could have been done. I'm thinking about how I'm going to go home and explain that this was a really, really challenging process. At the same time, the thing that we fought the hardest for, we got the minimum of that, but we got that, and with that I can work.
As things stand, there's a range of promises by many countries to take action on climate change. But even if they're fulfilled, they would still lead to dangerous temperatures in the coming decades. And all the time, emissions keep rising. It's now up to the UK to handle this process, taking over the chair ahead of the next big summit, which will be staged in Glasgow next November. Ministers and officials face the task of trying to persuade the world to change course or risk another weak outcome.
Our science editor David Shukman. To India next, where tensions have been rising between police and demonstrators protesting against a new citizenship law. It allows migrants fleeing religious persecution in some neighbouring countries to claim Indian citizenship, as long as they're not Muslim. The law sparked nationwide protests when it was passed on Wednesday, but the demonstrations have now taken a violent turn. Many accused the police of using excessive force, especially when they moved into the predominantly Muslim Jamia University on Sunday. This student was on the university campus at the time.
We were trying to escape, but we could not because police was everywhere and they were throwing tear gas canisters and we could not see. And then finally we reached near the library and we saw all these policemen barging in and beating us black and blue. And then I climbed the stairs and there were 11 of us locked inside washroom. And then we were praying. We were just praying this to stop.
Yogendra Yadav is a political activist based in Delhi and was also at the campus. He spoke to my colleague James Menendez about what he saw.
The situation took a turn for the worse. Three buses were burned. There was stone pelting from probably both sides. But all this happened outside the university campus. Then the police chased the students into the university. Large number of students went inside the library building. The police entered the library, beat them up there, chased them into hostels. And it's been a pretty brutal situation. This has led to about more than 100 students receiving injuries. And it seems about 100 students have been detained so far.
Does it feel like the police's patience ran out today in Delhi? Is that what happened, do you think?
Well, Delhi hasn't had much of incidents of a kind which would require police to have enormous patience. This protest has begun only 3 days ago, and the situation in Jamia University was not anything that called for any extreme action. But unfortunately, the Indian police is used to rather heavy-handed ways of dealing with protests. And what we saw in Jamia University today was a classic example of that.
In terms of the bill itself, I mean, the government insists this is about helping religious minorities in other countries who are fleeing persecution. I mean, that doesn't sound too bad.
Honestly, this is a joke. This is a fig leaf. It would raise anyone's eyebrows that a government which has been known to be anti-minority suddenly becomes extremely sensitive about religious minorities outside the country. But even if that were to be the case, the simple question is, why these three countries? The bordering countries of India include Nepal, include China, include Myanmar. Why not open your heart to minorities from these three countries? If India is so concerned about persecution, which it should be, why is it that it's focusing only on religious persecution and not persecution of other kinds? And even if the government were to think only of religious persecution only in these three countries, why not think of Muslims who face religious persecution? In Pakistan, for example, Ahmadiyyas face religious persecution. So I'm afraid this is a joke that no one takes seriously. The long-term aim is to signal that Muslims are not welcome to India.
Yogendra Yadav with James Menendez. A BBC investigation has uncovered an illegal network that lures women from Africa to India, where they're forced into prostitution. The victims are mostly from Kenya, Uganda, Nigeria, Tanzania and Rwanda. They have their passports confiscated and their movements restricted by their brothel madams until they've paid off an inflated fee for their travel costs. One woman, Grace, who was trafficked from Kenya, agreed to go undercover for BBC Africa. Our correspondent Niasha Kadandara has more on her ordeal.
I'm Grace. I'm a singer. I'm a musician. I'm a dancer and I'm an actress. I want to become famous and have a good life.
Grace saw a post in a friend's WhatsApp group offering work in India.
Hearing that it's good money, I went for it. I decided, okay.
But when she arrived in New Delhi, Grace began to realize she was trapped in a nightmare. She was taken to a brothel and had her passport confiscated by a woman called Goldie, who had paid for Grace's travel to India. Goldie told Grace that she now owed almost $4,000, more than seven times the actual cost of a ticket to India. There was only one way to pay the debt.
Just wear a good dress when you go for sex with your client.
Prostitution for me, something that I had said an X to. I was even telling, in my prayers, I was telling God, let it be the last thing I'll ever want to do in my life.
For 5 months, Grace lived in this room with four other trafficked women.
Very many times we'd bring clients in the house. or you go to hotels.
Grace agreed to wear a hidden camera and take us inside the brutal world of an African Indian sex ring.
It's okay, I'm good to go.
All right.
The women were turned out to solicit men in local pickup bars known as kitchens. These are illegal clubs set to cater for the many African men who live and work in New Delhi.
The first day I went there, I looked and I saw so many girls. So many girls. And what you do is you sit down and then a man has to come and choose.
We identified at least 15 kitchens in South Delhi where scores of African women were forced to sell their bodies. Grace pointed out the man who she knew as being at the heart of the sex trade in her area.
This was chairman.
His name is Eddie.
Yeah.
How are you?
I'm good. Hmm? You have 2 guests or 1 guest?
During our investigation, he offered to help Grace import a woman from Kenya to work under her. Grace pretended to be interested.
What's the process of bringing a girl? You know, I don't know anything.
Don't
I don't
give
money
to the
agent.
No,
or to the girl. I give to agent.
You know, as much as the person is coming to Nairobi, agents will give the passport, even the birth certificates.
This is how the network grows. Women pay off their debts as sex workers, and then, with no other employment options, start operating as madams. With the evidence gathered by Grace, we confronted Eddie.
Eddie! Hi, how are you? Good. My name is Nyasha Kadandara. I'm from BBC Africa Eye. We have evidence against you and we want to talk to you about the sex trade that you are involved in. Yes, the sex trade that you are involved in.
You can show me the evidence.
We do. We have it right here. This is a right of reply for you to come and respond to BBC. We look forward to hearing your response.
All right.
We contacted Eddie Anide 3 times. He denied trafficking any woman from Kenya to India. Goldie gave no response to our allegations of trafficking and brothel keeping. Africa Eye helped Grace to return to Kenya, where she is now rebuilding her life.
How does it feel to be home?
It's so good, so good. I don't know, I can't believe I'm still in Kenya. I can't still believe. I think I'm going to believe when I sleep and wake up tomorrow.
And that was Grace ending that report by Nyasha Kadandara. Anti-government militias have gone on a killing spree in the east of the Democratic Republic of Congo. At least 22 civilians are reported to have been murdered during the attack, with officials fearing that more bodies will still be found. Our Africa regional editor Will Ross told me more.
We hear from local officials that ADF rebels came at night armed with machetes and guns, and they attacked a village called Ntombi, which is north of the city of Beni, a remote area. Now, the officials are saying that they're still looking for bodies, and it's possible that more people will be found, people who had, you know, run away from the attackers in the panic at night.
And 13 of the 22 people who we know to have died are women.
What's been happening in recent weeks is the ADF appear to have been punishing villages, perhaps villages that they think are giving information to the Congolese military. Now, the Congolese military has launched an operation that began